Welcome to Indie Business Radio for Monday, June 15th, 2009. I'm your host, Donna Maria, and you have arrived at the one place where we empower you to enjoy your life, build your business, and have your way. Well, you know, when you do live radio, sometimes things just don't go according to plan, and today is one of those days. We had a couple of technical difficulties. I'm not sure how well we ironed them out, but thanks to Kevin, our show engineer, and the patience of our guests, I think we've done a pretty good job of it. Throughout the show, though, you may notice a difference in the audio. You may have to turn your volume up a little bit louder than you normally do, which, as you know, for me is kind of a change because I'm always talking so loud. But believe it or not, you may have to turn your volume up today to hear me. So I'm going to do my best to make sure that I deliver on this show. And it should be pretty easy for me to do because today's guest is awesome. His name is Gerald Sindel. He is the author of The Genius Machine, The 11 Steps That Turn Raw Ideas into Brilliance. Gerald Sindel is the founder of Thought Leaders International, a firm that guides leaders and organizations of all kinds to realize their inherent brilliance. And I've been reading this book, and I'm really enjoying how it breaks down the process of turning that nugget of an idea that you have in your head into something tangible that you can use for your business. And don't we all want to do that? So without further ado, I'm excited to introduce you to Gerald Sindel. Welcome to the show, Gerald.
Thanks, Donna Maria. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you know, your book kind of goes through 11 steps, and it's a very easy read, and it breaks things down really easily, and we're going to get into some of those steps, Jerry, but I want to ask you first, tell me what it is that you saw in the business book environment that generated your idea that there was a need for a book like this.
Well, I have been working pretty much strictly with business consultants, business CEOs, and business leaders to help them get their books developed because I realized a few decades ago that there were a number of people that needed to be successfully published just for the sake of their business. And so as a publishing expert, I knew that I could help them get through the publishing process so that when we were through with the process, they would be successfully published, not for the sake of the publisher, but for the sake of the consultant or the business leader.
Right.
So in the process of working with all these individuals over a period of time, I realized the same issues kept coming up again and again. And they were eventually the idea of how do you develop someone's ideas so that they work robustly and so that they can succeed in the marketplace of ideas.
Now, Jerry, I want to ask you about that. You work with a lot of authors, and I can tell that from the book, and I think the book, in fact, says that. One of the things I want to ask you, though, is because of today's business environment, do you see the benefit for people who are maybe not actually looking to write a book? It's not something that they feel like they're compelled to do or they've always wanted to do. But because they have a business, it's something that they should consider because of the benefits to their business, no matter what business they're in. Do you sort of see that in today's digital environment?
You mean writing a book?
Yeah. I mean, I know that for people who want to write books, it's a great thing to do. But my question is, because a lot of my listeners are people that sell different products. They don't necessarily... they're not authors. They're not really compelled to write a book like many authors are. You know, we feel like there's something inside of us that just has to come out on paper. So
sure.
I guess my question is, when you work with different businesses, do you see benefits of having them, no matter what it is they sell, to create some written document that can help drive traffic to their website or help share their passions and their expertise in a way that can help influence customers to make positive purchasing decisions from them?
Well, I think the most important written document that every business has to have is a website and a landing page that's really compelling. So a lot of my work with every author and every business, one of the first things we have to look at is making sure their web page is well differentiated. And that work of differentiation and thinking things through and thinking about what the user is looking for and talking to that user in their language, not in our language, Those are universal for every business person.
Do you find that it helps business owners if they can create a book or an e-book or some sort of, you know, 3, 4, 5 or longer downloadable document that people can read to sort of understand where they're coming from and who they are? This is kind of makes me think about chapter 2 in your book, which talks about identity.
It's useful for a lot of people. If people are in B2B areas, you know, creating white papers that distinguish oneself are very, very important. If you're talking to the consumer, I don't think it's as important to have a lot of material to download. Mm-hmm. I think you simply must make it very, very as efficiently as possible, clear who you are, what you stand for, what you're trying to do, what service you're offering. And again, this basic thing of how you're differentiated. That's what really counts.
And when one of the steps in your book, it's step number two, it talks about identity, and there's a lot of things in here that really sort of stood out to me for any business owner, whether you're an author or not, Jerry, and that has to do with the importance of identifying who you are before you even move to what it is that you're going to create. Can you elaborate on that importance?
I can't. I do a fair amount of public speaking, and one of the most interesting things when I speak is I get to this certain topic. We talk about differentiation and identity. I suddenly look in a room and I realize I'm seeing every pair of eyes look at me and no one is blinking. It's almost a creepy feeling because this issue of differentiation is the most challenging for people, and yet in some ways it's the easiest thing you can do. I point out to people that, you know, we spend a lot of our lives trying to be like other people, and a lot of our education is shaped to make us and give us skills that are sort of universal. But the truth of the matter is, none of us can be like anyone else. So this work of differentiation is really about getting to the truth of who we are. And when we get there, then it's effortless and natural for us to talk about why we're doing what we're doing. There may be, 500,000 attorneys in the United States, but each one is an attorney for a different reason. And in explaining why we're an attorney, that tells the person who's visiting you and possibly becoming a client why you're the right attorney for them.
And let's break that down even further for very small businesses, because that's what my listenership is composed largely of, very small businesses and startup companies. And sometimes, it's hard to move past how great my product is. My product is so great. Here it is on my website. You should buy it and because it will make your life better and it contains these ingredients and it's a wonderful thing. Are you saying that it's equally as important for us to create that kind of identity with our customers so that they are led to make that purchasing decision? Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, it is. We need to know not just what's unique and wonderful and valuable about the product, but we need to know why the person created that company to create that product. The story behind it, the passion that drove someone to do it, is even more important than the benefits of the product themselves.
And is that because consumers are, is that something new, Jerry, or is that something that's just always
been
the case? It's just
always
different
been.
Because the web has changed things. How does that work?
I think, the web has made the world much more open to us, but we need to know who we're talking to. And we can't differentiate. If you're looking at a product that's going to take care of the fleas on your dog, for instance, if that product is coming from someone who's really knowledgeable about chemistry and is in love with their dogs, I'm going to have a little better feeling about that product for my dog than someone who has been working for a very large pet company who may have, made a derivative formula and is not quite so concerned about the health of my pet. So I would look for the person behind the product to make a judgment about what I'm going to buy.
This morning I had a bagel at Panera Bread, which is one of my favorite places to go and have coffee. And when I walked in the door, the first thing I saw was a display of bagels. And it was a nice bag of 12 bagels. And the label said, Panera Bread, 12 bagels, and it listed the flavors. And in big print, right underneath all that, it said these bagels were made by Baker Mike.
Mm-hmm.
And so is that sort of an example of how even a large company can kind of personalize the experience beyond just being the person that makes really good bagels?
Absolutely. You really want to know who inspected that. If it's a product, you see a little sticker that says inspected by so-and-so, or
right.
It's something is signed. It completely transforms the user experience. It makes you know that there was someone who was responsible for the quality of what you got and who stands behind it.
Interesting, because maybe I'm showing a little bit of my age when I say this, but I can remember watching commercials as a child, and I can't remember exactly which ones they were. But, Jerry, there would be things like inspected by inspector number 3589. And there would be a person standing there with a badge on that said, inspector number whatever. And it's interesting to me because now people wouldn't dream of doing that. It's not inspector number. It's inspected by Sally or whoever it is.
Oh, the personalization has been definitely elevated to the individual person, and it helps a great deal. I have been recently in the news because I wrote an open letter to General Motors a few weeks ago when they were in their first day of bankruptcy. I wrote a letter to Fritz Henderson, the CEO of General Motors. One of those things I put up on Huffington Post, and of course the internet equalizes voices in such a strange way that 2 days later there was an open letter posted at General Motors to me.
Yeah.
Did you happen to see that?
No, I didn't. Tell me about it.
So the open letter back, and my letter was very concerned about would General Motors be able to be true to its identity, to rediscover it, to really take the retreats that are necessary over the next few months to figure out who they are so that everything they do from now on would respect the authenticity of what drives General Motors and the people there to create value, really to get clear about who they are. And I simply had remarked about Mr. Henderson's comments the first day that General Motors was going to rely upon great design as one of the strengths to turn around and save General Motors. And I simply said in my little letter, it sounded a little snarky, but I really meant it. I mean, how can you go out and rely on great design when you've produced so much terrible design in your history? That was the letter. And so the answer that came back to me was from the vice president of design at General Motors, so a wonderful guy named Ed Welburn, who has been a GM since 1972, and he talked with passion about their commitment to design. I have the feeling he didn't control all the bad design that was done by General Motors. He's been responsible for a lot of the great design. And so clearly he took it upon himself to say, yes, we will be able to express ourselves and our capacity for great design from now on. I think it remains to be seen if that's true or not. But that's as basic an identity issue as you can have. It's important for giant corporations, and it's important for the individual operator.
Do you think it's an overstatement to say that if you're relying on the internet for the bulk of your sales, if your website and your other online locations, your Twitter page, or wherever you are in the internet, if you have not included information that really does bolster your identity and help you connect with people that visit in that kind of personal, identified kind of way, that your business is going to kind of be more background noise than anything else?
If you don't do that, you'll be undifferentiated. You'll be the same as everybody else. You'll be competing in a very noisy environment, and people will not hear you. One of the things I tell my authors, and it's the same thing for anybody designing a web page or a business, until people know who you are and think that they get who you are, they'll be looking at everything you do, and they'll be trying to peek under the corners and figure out, well, who's there? Who's that person behind the mask? Who's really there? Who are you? And if you simply make that task easy for your buyer, your prospective buyer, by getting it out in front as quickly as possible, they can then go about the business of looking at what it is you're offering. But until you let them know who you are, they'll constantly be looking, trying to figure it out, and deconstructing you to get to the truth.
We're talking to Gerald Sandel, the author of The Genius Machine, The 11 Steps That Turn Raw Ideas into Brilliance. And we've been focusing on the step of identifying yourself to your customers and your prospects to make the buying process and the relationship process easier and to facilitate sales. This has just been such a valuable piece of information, and I know it's helping me, and I know it's helping everyone who's listening to make sure that your identity is clear so your customers aren't left guessing about that. We're going to take our first break. We're going to come back and talk some more with Gerald. This is Indie Business Radio. We'll be right back.
Why is everyone listening to GlobalTalkRadio.com? Because it's the future of talk radio. Every day, more and more people are finding internet radio as not just an alternative media, but as a replacement to traditional AM and FM broadcast stations. Internet radio offers a wider variety of programs, convenient on-demand listening that meets your schedule, and fewer commercial interruptions. And GlobalTalkRadio.com is already leading the way by matching this content with a highly targeted internet audience. GlobalTalkRadio.com offers its listeners one of the widest programming varieties on the internet, from business and finance to self-improvement, paranormal, health, literature, romance, politics, and more. There are also opportunities for prospective hosts who would like to host their own weekly or one-time talk shows. Want to learn more? Check us out at www.globaltalkradio.com and see the future of talk radio today.
Welcome back to Indie Business Radio. I'm your host, Donna Maria, and my guest today is the author of The Genius Machine. His name is Gerald Sindel, and the subtitle of the book is The 11 Steps That Turn Raw Ideas into Brilliance. And these are 11 steps that are very easy to embrace and understand. I strongly recommend that you take a look at this book and what it has to offer, because it really does break things down in bite-sized chunks that any business owner can use to go from an idea to something tangible that you can sell in your business. Before we took our first break, we were talking about the importance of identifying yourself to your audience in order to facilitate those sales. Otherwise, you'll just be background noise. And Gerald was saying that you can't synthesize your identity. What does that mean, Gerald?
It means, if people often think about identity as the same thing as branding, like something you can make up. But you cannot make up the truth of who you are. Brands, good brands, flow from the truth of identity. So identity is the wellspring. I call it the fingerprint of the soul. It's who we really are. And the way to get to identity, one way, is to ask ourselves a tough but interesting question, which is, if the thing we had to offer to the world was never heard or never succeeded in the world, what would the world have lost? What would the world not have seen? And when we can begin to fill in that space, that's who we are. That's what we're driven to contribute. That's our way of seeing things. That's our identity.
And that's kind of, from a business perspective, isn't that what really makes us relevant? I mean, I'm going to read from page 31 of your book. It says, if you were not successful in getting your way of seeing things out into the world, what is it the world would have lost? Are our customers expecting us to be able to answer that question for them, even though they may not actually be tangibly asking that?
Yes, I think they are asking that. Obviously, our customers want us to perform a service for them or give them a product they need. It's our way of doing that that distinguishes us, because it defines, in a way, that we see how the world works. So we could be something as generic as a tax accountant, but if we understand accounting for someone's taxes in a way that helps their life in a certain way, or gives them a sense of security or a sense of peace or well-being or completeness or a sense of fairness, whatever it is we do, in our way of doing that thing, for the right person, we are the absolute right tax accountant.
And I want to read a section of your book that has to do with how we relate what you just said to setting goals for our business. And for your reference, we're on page 25 of your book. One of the things that I see small business owners struggling with greatly, Jerry, is, you know, the changing landscape. We live in a world today where everything is moving so fast, and you may, you know, have an idea for a business on, you know, in June, and then you work really hard to get everything together in 5 or 6 months, and then by then you have to change everything because everything's changed. I want to read this from your book and ask you to elaborate a little, maybe share some examples of some of your clients who've dealt with this, and how can small businesses do this? It says, the goals we set at the beginning of a project begin to age from the moment we set them. Every few weeks or months, we need to determine whether what we have been working towards is tied to a time and context that no longer exists. Fuel costs can change. Tastes change. Other innovations create a constantly evolving environment. The intended audience we begin with may not be the same audience that we will be trying to reach when we're ready to go to market.
Yep.
That is, that would be terrifying to me if I was starting a business today.
I think it's terrifying, and it's also true. It's recognizing that will help us not get our blinkers on and avoid what's going on in terms of change. So while we're developing whatever we're developing, we really have to pay attention to our intended core user and saying what's changing for them, what's changing the environment. For For instance, if you were about to launch a retail business in this environment in the last 6 months and you were thinking about doing a pilot program in a shopping mall, you would really have to think twice about whether this is the right time to do that. But more importantly, you also have to look at the things that are not changing. And what doesn't change is your identity, number one, so that's one of the bedrocks you can rely upon. And the other thing that doesn't change, hopefully, or you need to look at very carefully, is the need of your user. So if their need to have a certain kind of clothing or care for themselves or service or something that might inspire them or whatever, if that need remains constant, even though the world may be turbulently changing, you know those two constants are still going to get together when you're ready to go to market.
And, you know, it's interesting that you say that because I want to ask you if this is relevant, too. I can't remember where I saw this over the weekend, but it was a YouTube video. The presentation by a business startup expert, I'm sorry if you're listening, I can't remember your name, but one of the things the person said was startup businesses or small businesses are most successful, the ones that are successful, do a really good job of shortening the cycle between when they start something and when the need to change it occurs. Does that make sense?
Of course, because in a dynamic environment, if it takes you longer to do something, the chances of you being out of sync by the time you get your product out there, the chances are increased all the time. So if you can turn around and launch in a month or two, it's much better, obviously, than 6 months or a year.
Yeah, and you know, have you, one of the things I've noticed in dealing with companies, and sometimes I'm guilty of this myself, I think maybe to some extent every small business owner experiences this, is that We try so hard and take so much time to get everything perfect that by the time it's perfect, the opportunity's gone or the great timing has been lost.
That's right. One of the great dangers for small business that I see again and again is when a small business has a product that can scale up to be useful for a very large buyer. For instance, people have great sales training or great service training, and they say, gee, that would be great for, you know, UPS. That would be great for someone with 500,000-600,000 employees if we could scale up. And they get caught up then with trying to sell to the very large buyer. And the problem with the very large buyer is you're in a complex sale, which is very, very slow. And people change positions, and before long, the small business goes broke trying to make that huge sale. It's a serious trap. And I see it again and again for small business, no matter how great the product.
Well, yeah, and one of the examples that this video gave, which I'd love your comment on because I thought it was so relevant, I can't remember the company names, but one of the examples was a company that started out doing online payment processing, not a bank in a traditional sense, but and it wasn't PayPal. It was another company that started out doing this, I think even before PayPal started doing it, online payment processing. You know, without exposing your credit card number and things like that. And they wanted to essentially grow into what PayPal now is. But a large online company came along, I think it was eBay. And what eBay wanted to do was work with someone, this was many years ago, that could provide that capability for them. And so what they did was they essentially got absorbed into eBay, which was not their original plan. So is that an example of how, you know, you start this thing, it's going to be this, but as life happens and technology evolves, you may have to turn it into something else that's more beneficial for you and the world?
Yeah, I mean, I think the safest thing if you're a small business with the potential to sell to an eBay or be even bought by an eBay is if you want to not bet the entire enterprise on that one sale, you need to grow to a certain size first before you can even approach an eBay to service them. That's one way to avoid the trap.
If they approached them or if eBay came along, and I can't even remember if it was eBay, but I guess the point I was trying to make is that you may have this plan that your business is going to look this way in 3 or 4 years, but if another opportunity comes along, you have to be able to quickly assess whether you need to change direction.
Yes, and I would say be very careful about betting the enterprise on the big sale.
Yeah. One of the things your book talks about is the importance of testing. You call it finding the breaking point. And it says, genius thinkers know that the only way to be certain something works is to discover the test that would prove the opposite. What do you mean by that?
I mean, we tend to be so hopeful and optimistic about what it is we're creating, we tend to be afraid of the tough questions. So this is an invitation to, at this point, once we've gotten to this level of development, we want to go find our harshest critics and, you know, have them give us their best stuff. This is the time when we're ready to talk to the devil's advocates and to say, okay, punch holes in this theory or tell me where it's wrong. And we're looking not to defend ourselves, but to see if they're right, what we can learn from it, and how we can make ourselves more robust. So this is the time of development where we finally open up for outside comment.
You have an opportunity, as you say, to observe and hear about what works, what doesn't work, so that you can adjust and move things forward that way. Why are people so afraid of doing that if it has so many benefits?
I think we get in the habit early. You know, there's certain stages to open things up. When we're first incubating, of course, we need to do our work robustly enough that we can fulfill our dream and make our project work in a way that we see it. And the only people we want to talk to then pretty much are people who are sympathetic advocates for us, who get it and want to help us get more robust and make it work. And then when it's ready to show, then we're ready to take on the critics. We have to let go of that protective shell and then be ready to pay very close attention to the things we've missed, the things we haven't seen. That's the right time to do that. But there's a right time to do that and a wrong time to do that.
And how do we know the difference?
The difference is when we think we've got it in pretty good shape. When we can explain what we've done, we know its value, we can communicate it, we think it's pretty intact. And so we're ready to show it. And that, you know, it's different for everything we're developing, but it's that point at which we're ready to take it out a little bit and take a few hits. But we don't want to do it too early because, you know, negativity too early will destroy creativity, and we don't want that.
You also talked, Jerry, about the importance of flattening the learning curve, and that's a fascinating way to put it to me, particularly for small business owners, because the learning curve literally starts at zero frequently when you've never had a business before, maybe never had any training. How important is that to do, and how can we generally go about doing that? I mean, is it just like Googling everything and learning, or mentoring? How do we flatten the learning curve?
Well, the reason we need to flatten the learning curve is because the learning curve is what we've been doing when we've been inside of our project, developing something that's complicated, and we're so busy filling out the bells and whistles and options and all the things we can do with what we're doing, we're totally enthralled with it. And of course, by this time, everything to us is fascinating and interesting, and we think it's just wonderful. The whole notion of completion, of getting out of our own point of view of what we've done, and thinking about this poor user out there, which we're about to give our product to, they know nothing about our product. All they have is a need. So by flattening the learning curve, means we've got to forget about all the things we know about our product, and we have to put ourselves in their shoes, who knows almost nothing about the product, and make it very, very easy for them to start to use it. And there are many things that they can do with us later on. Great abilities, built-in little secrets. We should save those to later. Get them using our product first. If we make it hard to try it out and use it, we'll never get a high level of adoption.
Now, I have heard that in this economy, I've heard some people say this is the best time to start a business. And there are a lot of examples out there of people who have started businesses during recessions and depressions over the years who have ultimately grown those businesses to be very successful. Do you agree with that statement?
I really do, but I'm a serial entrepreneur, so I would anyway. But I have been in enough recessions that I know that if you're developing something new and incubating it, as that recession begins to recover, it's wonderful to be launching your product as the country comes out of recession. It's a perfect thing. The noise level is generally not so severe when you're coming out of recession because fewer things have launched. Mm-hmm. You're more likely to have less competition. You obviously have to be able to survive. I mean, and I think that in many ways the challenges of incubating a new company or new venture in a recession teaches you pretty good lessons about frugality.
Yeah, and I know your book doesn't focus specifically on that, but I guess part of what you need to do to actually get your idea into something that's brilliant, which means that it's tangible and people can use it, is you do have to really watch every penny.
You really do. My book is not so much about business plans. It's certainly not about the financial side of a business plan. it doesn't touch that at all. I'm really about the idea side of the business plan.
You know, and I guess, you know, there's a lot of information out there on money management when you're planning a business. So, and that's one reason why I really enjoy this so much, because I literally took the subtitle of your book, The 11 Steps to Turn Raw Ideas into Brilliance, as a challenge. I was like, okay, you know, I need some help there. I could really, if I could do it in 11 steps, and what is it, 100 pages or so, then count me in. We're going to come back and talk more with Gerald Sindel about his book, The Genius Machine, and all the tips he can offer to help us move from a creative nugget in our heads to something that can really help people and also keep our businesses profitable. This is Indie Business Radio. We'll be right back.
Want to stay on top of what's new in the radio industry? Sign up for a free subscription to The Future of Talk Radio, available exclusively to listeners of globaltalkradio.com, and find out what's new in the world of online radio. Listeners can find out about new shows and special guests. People with something special to offer can find out how to become a guest and how to prepare for an interview. And prospective hosts will find a valuable resource for everything from planning their new program to selecting topics and guests, recouping expenses by selling advertising, and more. Sign up today for your free subscription to The Future of Talk Radio by visiting www.globaltalkradio.com and learn about the future of talk radio today.
Welcome back to Indie Business Radio. We're talking with Gerald Sindel, the author of The Genius Machine, and he's been going through some of the steps that he outlines in this book, the 11 steps that we all need to incorporate into our business lives in order to turn our ideas, and of course we as small business owners have no shortage of those, but we can't implement all of them, and Gerald's book shares with us how we can take some of them at least and turn them into tangible products and services that we can offer. We've talked a lot about identifying who you are and setting your goals. And Gerald, you say that you call something advocacy, and you talk about the importance of advocacy as a small business. And you say it's a curator of hooks for your business. Tell us what you mean by that.
By curator of hooks, I mean you're always looking for the little stories, the bits or pieces that when you tell them about your product or your service, that people can repeat them to other people, the things that stick forever. So, for instance, and I'll tell you how we look for them later on, but one of the things I did as a publisher was I started the Elvis sightings revolution in this country, the riot of Elvis sightings. I was responsible for that personally as a publisher when I published a book called Is Elvis Alive? So if someone were to talk about me tomorrow, one thing they might remember is, oh, yeah, he's the guy who did the Elvis sightings thing. He's responsible for that. That's a hook that will stick with me forever.
Okay.
So an advocacy hook hopefully will tell you about someone's value, their ability to do something that's closely related to your product. One of the things we do is when we begin to think about our product, we look at that, especially at testing, we look for what people say about it. So if I was a Procter & Gamble and I'm doing focus groups, and someone says, you know, that spot has been in that pair of pants for 12 years and never gone out before, I would know immediately that I had one of the major advocacy hooks for that product of all time. We're always looking for the stories, the example, the narrative that is the, oh, wow, I can't believe it, that's wonderful. And it's not like an elevator pitch. An elevator pitch is that long, that 20-second thing that tells people who we are in sort of a catchy way. This is not like that. An elevator pitch is not something you expect someone to repeat to others. And the test of an advocacy hook is that can another person tell it to a third person? And can that third person tell it to a fourth person? And if you get that right, you're in really good shape.
Well, this is really interesting that you said that, because to say it against the backdrop of the social networking world that we live in gives what you just said a whole new meaning, does it not?
That's right. If we can get it down to 140 characters, we're really in business.
Well, let's talk about that. Maybe not necessarily just with respect to Twitter, because if I understood you correctly, you just said that we all need a hook, at least one. We've got to have a hook. It's that special thing about you. In your case, it was the Elvis phenomenon. But does it have to be something so, you know, I mean, Elvis, everybody knows who that is. Does it have to be something like earth-shattering like that?
No, it has to be something that simply is a clue about success. So if someone would say about you, I would trust them with my X, and you can fill in the X. And if they would say that, and it would be true, then that's an advocacy hook.
Okay, and so then the next step is, in order to get those, you have to put yourself out there in a way that invites those kinds of comments so that then you can identify and create your hook.
Yes, and sometimes you have to create them, too. You can just create them from the intention of what it is you're trying to create. One of the things I was written back to General Motors Design about was that they cannot just design great cars and then throw them over the fence for their marketing people to then explain what's so great about them. That design themselves need to take responsibility for explaining what is so great about what they've done with the interior design, why those controls work so well, why the body shape is such a wonderful integrated piece of beauty, and so on. They have to start the conversation and be advocates first. You can't, and that's really the point of the advocacy section, is you cannot delegate it to someone else. Now, many of us will let our customers define us for ourselves. We kind of, you know, open our storefronts or open our business, and then we wait to see what people think about us. And we wait for that advocacy to come. And if we do that, it's never going to be the way we want it to be.
So what we do then is, in a nutshell, we create the advocacy points, we put them out there in conjunction with what we're doing, and listen to customers as they give feedback, because the advocacy points or the hooks may need to change a little bit.
Wait, there's no question about it. Advocacy hooks only work if they work. But the main thing is that we have to take responsibility for being our own advocates first. We can't just create the thing and hope for the best.
Okay, I'm going to break this down into a tangible example, and I'm going to ask you if this applies. I was talking with someone yesterday who is starting a business as an author and a speaker, and she's an advocate for women who are single moms and maybe not in the best financial position and, you know, discouraged and all the other stuff that single moms go through. And one of the things we talked about was she wanted to contact some, you know, shelters in the area and, you know, other nonprofit organizations that may be interested in engaging her services to set up some programs to help people in this position. So she said to me she was going to be giving them a call or sending them information, and she would ask them what it was that they needed.
Mm-hmm.
And what
they don't know the connection. A third party, the person she's selling to, cannot possibly know how what she has to offer fits with what they think that their ultimate user, that the woman, is going to need.
Okay,
only,
good. And I want to explore that with you, because so many times we shy away from saying, okay, I'm this person, I offer this, and here's the three things I bring to the table, and I think I can help you. What do you think? And sort of, to me, it seemed like when we were talking that the position that she was going to take was going to make it hard for the person she wanted to hire her to actually hire her, because then they had to do all the work and figure out what they needed.
Yeah, she's letting other people define her, or begging for people to define her. And one reason is it's very difficult. What she needs to be able to say is, when I speak to a group of women, not a woman in the room will leave that room without knowing the following three things.
Okay.
And if she can say that, and I'm sure they'll be unique to her.
Right.
I hope they'll be unique to her. Then she's well along her way.
So when you're selling, let's transition this to selling a product. If you, a lot of my listeners sell health and lifestyle and beauty products. So we get your identity down and know who you are and what your purpose is, and, you know, empowering women or making them feel beautiful or whatever the case may be. And then you have your hooks, which you develop by saying the people that use this product experience these three things, and is that sort of what you mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Here's what we constantly hear. So-and-so writes in from North Carolina and said, I've tried everything on the planet. This is the first thing that X, Y, and Z.
Okay.
If that matches what it is you're trying to do, then you really want to use that.
So in doing this, we actually empower ourselves, right, and our business to communicate what we're able to do, which makes a purchasing decision or a collaborative decision easy for the person that we're talking to.
That's right. In a crowded market like health and beauty, we cannot get everyone to buy all of our products. We can only get certain people to buy our products. And if we know who we're making our products for, then we need to know what's unique about them, what the connection is going to be between what we're doing and what they want, and we then reinforce that with language that they'll say, oh, she's talking to me.
And then you said what you do is you put it out there in a way that causes people to repeat it. That's where we kind of got into the social media thing. Can you elaborate, maybe not necessarily with respect specifically to social media, but can you elaborate on that concept? Again, we're talking about businesses who are largely relying on the Internet for their sales. Can you elaborate on what you mean by once you've got your identity, you've got your hook, and I know I'm greatly simplifying everything.
No, it's great.
That you're able then to put it out there in a way that causes people to repeat it for you. Can you share what you mean by that? I think that must be so important.
Now, not everyone is going to repeat it at all. But what you do want is to give people the tools so when they repeat it or when they talk about it, talking to a friend about a beauty product they're using, you want the language they use to be easily available for them. And if you put it on the package or put it in the marketing materials in a way that makes total sense and so that someone can say, you know, this product makes me feel completely differently about beauty products. Or this product, you know, whatever it is that you want them to say, give them the language. Don't ask for them to make it up.
Okay, that's really interesting. So, well, everybody talked about the power of a testimonial. Don't you want your customers to make that up? That could turn into a hook, right?
I do want customers to do testimonials, but, you know, I'm quite willing to suggest, if I'm looking for testimonials, mm-hmm. to suggest to core customers the things I'm looking for them to say. Mm-hmm. And what I would say is, if you really value what I've created, it would be very helpful if you would give an endorsement of it. And the things that I think you value are this, this, and this. If that's true, could you use that language? Again, I would not put the burden of an endorsement, of the endorsement language, on my user unless you get the 1 in 1,000 user who gets it. But the chances of the user using the language you want in a way that really works for you is not great. The users are going to come back with generic, not well-differentiated language.
Right. And, you know, it's funny. I can remember getting requests from young people to write letters of reference. And the first thing that comes to my mind, even though I know how well they did, I know some of their characteristics that other employers might be interested in, the first thing that comes to my mind when I get something that just says, would you write a letter of reference for me, is what do you want me to say?
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because, of course, I know enough. I'm intelligent. I can write. I can say, you know, this person's responsible or whatever. But the thing, I guess, that what you're saying, and I'm trying to draw an analogy here, is that when people are asked to say something, they need to be kind of told what you want them to say.
It really helps. And when authors go looking for blurbs, and blurbs are very important in helping you find the right readers, I always suggest, you know, don't depend upon that other reader or author you're going to go to for a little quote. Tell them what it is you want. Make it easy for them.
Right, right. Excellent point. And so we get our identity created. We are responsible for it. We describe it. We put it out there, put the products around that, and have our hooks and our advocacy points and, you know, all the other things that your book mentions are so fundamental. But I think just that process, which, of course, we're not able to cover everything on one radio show, but I love that flow, that create your identity, put it into your product, and then create the hooks that then allow you to share your product or service and get people talking about it.
Mm-hmm. It's one simple straight-line differentiation product.
Right, and of course, your book puts a lot of flesh on that, and really just given that very high-level scratch-the-surface overview. What's really meaty about this book is that it breaks it down without making it too hard to understand and grasp. So for those of you listening, this is a wonderful book to add to your list. It's just, you know, just 140 pages. It's very easy and fun to read, and there's a lot in here for you to apply to your business. It's The Genius Machine, 11 Steps That Turn Raw Ideas Into Brilliance by Gerald Sindel. And in closing, Jerry, where do we go to find out more about you?
Well, first, Donna Marie, I want to thank you for this terrific interview. I mean, that's wonderful to talk to someone who gets the book so well and is so enthusiastic, and obviously you can put it to use or and share it with people. Yeah. I like to work with anyone who's trying to do something that is important to them, something that's valuable. So I work on book development, I work on new business launches, I work on large businesses, too. I work with Yahoo and helping them launch a big book recently. They can find me in two places. One is Thought Leaders, INTL, for international. That's my website, and I blog at on Endleofon, which means 11. It's spelled ENDLEOFON.com.
Great. Well, we'll be checking you out at both of those places, Endleofon.com and Thought Leaders, INTL. Jerry, thank you so much for joining us today on Indie Business Radio. I look forward to seeing you guys next week. Thanks for hanging in here with us and the technical challenges that we had. I'll talk with you next Monday. In the meantime, enjoy your life. Build your business and have your way.
You're listening to GlobalTalkRadio.com.